Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, I just realized something important.
Oh, yeah? What's that, Jim?
You and Robert are both still talking. All right.
I don't know if that's important, but... All right.
All right, Patrick, sometimes when we do interviews, they just go so well, and they just keep going and going and going, that it's too much for one episode.
That's right. Right. Yeah, we get to talking, and suddenly you look down, and the tape's been rolling for more than 20 minutes. So right. It's really cool, yeah.
That's right. So today, you're going to get part two of our interview with Robert Ellis Orrell. He is had a successful career as a musician and a songwriter and a record label owner. Sort of a music mogul in some ways.
Yeah, totally, Jim. And what I found so fascinating about this conversation is the different viewpoints that he's been able to look at the music industry right. from, like all different shapes, sizes, and angles, and still is into it.
That's
still
right.
Has a really evenly balanced perspective about it all. So I thought that was great.
And when you get a chance, check out Robert's new album, his new solo yep. album, 467 Surf and Gun Club, and you can find that on the streamings, and there's also a physical product available. He mentions yep. The vinyl, I think, comes out this month or next, so give that a spin when you have a chance, peoples. And yep. As I mentioned yesterday, I kind of teased this a little bit. What you're going to hear at the end of this interview is him talking about how he had a hand in the early success of someone who became a music superstar.
Superstar, truly.
I'm just going to go ahead and tell you guys, because I want you to listen to this. It's Taylor Swift. So there you go.
T-Swift.
Yep. So you're going to want to hear that.
I've seen her before, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. All right, and so with that, let's get to the second part of our interview with Robert Ellis Orrell.
And I made you laugh, and I took your hand, I helped you up so you could see the band, and the air was warm, and the clouds had cleared, and the rest of the world all but disappeared, and the music played in the sweet, and we made it.
Let's talk about your new album, Robert. I mean, yeah. Did the pandemic somehow play into, what's coming out? Or
never would have happened without it.
Okay. So tell us about that. I'm so interested in how artists have reacted to what we had to go through as a human planet.
So I have a immune disorder, and we had just bought this house down in Florida to as we get older, spend the winters and stuff. And we didn't know anybody. And this is when it was getting serious. This is February, March, working into April. And I was like, I don't have anything up on even streaming. There's five albums that I made, 97, 99, and three in the 2000s that I made that aren't even on streamers, because I never tended to that artist part of my life. I was a songwriter, and I just like, whatever, this is stuff I'm throwing out there for fun. And
right.
I thought, well, I gotta get those up on the internet, and I gotta get my first three albums from RCA up. Why aren't they up on the only thing that was on streamers was my country record, which I'm proud of, but it was a real aberration in my career. Someone offered me a record deal on RCA as a country artist, and I wasn't going to argue with them. I had two boys and a daughter on the way, so I was like, me? Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm a country artist.
Yes, I am now. Now that you said it, it rings true. So I started thinking about this record. that I had started at Infinity Cat around the time when you guys came to visit us at Infinity Cat for right. the Daddy Issues interview. And I thought, this might be the best thing I've ever done. I mean, it was so full of, like, I was just writing about this space that we were in, imagining it as a bar. And I had already written 6 or 7 songs. So I went onto my hard drive down in Florida, and I was like, what? I'd already finished all the vocals, and that means on a lot of songs, 24 tracks to 30 tracks, 32 tracks of vocals. I love doing vocals, and all the keyboard parts and percussion things and any bits that I could play and fake it on the guitar or whatever. And I said, if I die, this will be on my hard drive. No one will ever hear it. So COVID completely that's the reason why I finished it. Mm. I just thought, I got to finish this. So I went back to, like, in 80 to 84, when I was on RCA, Don Walden played the bass and Cook Lowry played the guitar. David Stefanelli was on drums. I had drums by a great drummer named Tommy Harden in Nashville, but I just thought, I'll send the tracks off to Cook and Don. Listen to this, and can you play on it? And they did. And what they sent back in most cases was like 10, 12, 14 tracks of different approaches. And there's nothing I like better to do than sit and let 6 hours go by while I cut and paste a lick from the first verse and put it just at the tail when it's going out, because that will be perfect here. So that's what I did. And then I got David to jump on at the end. I asked other friends to throw on this and that. Bill Lloyd played some amazing guitars on that song, Iceberg. And I finished it because of COVID. So, I mean, I'd rather we didn't have COVID and we didn't have this record.
Yeah, right. No.
Yeah, I'm not saying.
But many artists have said this, that there's, you know, if there is a silver lining in it, it provided this, like, opportunity for new creativity, right?
Yeah. And yeah. And by the way, I had six or seven songs. And so I thought, well, I want to make this an album about 467 Surfing Gun Club. So I need to write some more songs. And I hadn't written a song in over a year. I was like, I was kind of like, my heart had been broken a number of times by developing an act, getting it to a label. And then, and this is just cliche, hey, thanks for stopping by, we'll take it from here. And it happens to everyone that produces acts,
right,
and gets them to a certain point where everybody goes, they're great. Yeah. 3 years ago, we started working on this and now they're great. That's what happens. Right. And I'm not complaining, but my heart was broken. And I thought, I'm done. I'm just done. And I didn't think I was going to make music again. And I hadn't written in a year. And I thought, well, now I need to fill in the gaps. First off, this whole album is like a fever dream. You know, I want to pretend it's a real place, but it's not. That's when I wrote In Dreams. And then I had this idea to sort of sum up my life as a songwriter, as a bartender. And that's when I wrote Life Behind Bars, because that's what bartenders do. They meet people and they get to know them for maybe one night. Or maybe they're regulars and they come in for a couple, 3 years at a time. And you get to know their name. You don't know much about them. But sometimes they spill their guts to you over the bar, which is what a songwriter tries to get. You know, if you're writing with an artist, you want them to get as sad as they can get or as happy as they can get about whatever's going on in their life as quick as you can. You just want them to, like, spill your guts to you. So I just, like, always thought that my career as a songwriter is kind of like being a bartender. You're still mixing some stuff up and trying to make, you know, something that tastes good to everybody.
When I look around this old place, I see the whole world face to face. Talkers and rockers and writers pulling all-nighters like they don't have a minute to waste. Now that I'm getting up in my years, I look back on the life I spent here, living with losers and winners, new saints. in old sinners and lovers of whiskey and beer. But I wouldn't change it for anything or anyone, and I couldn't anyway, 'cause yesterday has come and gone. We're lonely and loving and selfish and hateful and hopeful and wistful and angry and grateful, and we all know each other.
So that's where that song came from. And then I had started writing a song with Leon Russell, who had was a friend. And I had this chorus. And Leon insisted on, I brought him the chorus. And because I tried to write something that sounded like Leon, because I was so scared of writing with Leon. And I'm going to, I mean, our kids were friends. Our wives were friends. He would come to parties at the house. He'd always he'd always sat in one place, never moved, and people would come to him, of course, and he would just tell these amazing stories, and he was like this magical person. And I remember one time he told me this story. I asked him, such an idiot. I asked him if he'd ever met the Beatles, and he goes, "Bobby, you got my Carney record?" And I was like, yeah, it's downstairs. I went downstairs and pulled it up. He goes, "Let's take a look at the credits." And there's George and Paul and Ringo playing on the whole friggin' record.
Wow.
And all I could say was, "Well, yeah, but where's John?" And he said, "John and Yoko were just, they were there, but they didn't, they were just sitting on the floor."
Course,
so
yeah.
So I reimagined this chorus as that guy that had been at the bar forever, and now he was retired, and he just sat in this little corner booth and told stories, and you wouldn't believe them because they were so magical, but they were true. And in Leon's case, they always were true, and they were always magical. And he was something else, that guy.
Yeah. Wow. And so, you know, Robert, and we won't spread this rumor if you don't want us to, but this is a concept album?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I know it's not fashionable. Neither is anything
Maybe
I'm
not
wearing.
With
yeah.
the public, but with yeah. me it is.
So,
yeah.
so I made a record in 1997 called Mistakes that was a concept album that was literally a story of how relationships go from the beginning to the end.
Yep.
And maybe rebounding a bit. And I had an unlimited budget because my publisher, they never argue with me about my demo budget. So I just go, all right, well, I have an 18-piece orchestra playing on this one. And I had so many guest artists, Ricky Skaggs, Alison Krauss, Michael McDonald, a couple of the guys from Bad Company were playing in town. They came and played on the record. I mean, if you look at the credits of that record, it's insane. But again, hadn't been up on, no one had heard it. Because it wasn't up on the streamers, because I had neglected it. And another record after that called Gravity. I had these records that just were out there in the ether, and now they're finally up there, and now I've lost my train of thought as to the answer to the question.
The concept.
The so concept. It is a concept.
You're talking
so
about concept.
It was that. Yeah. So Mistakes is a literal telling of a story.
Yeah.
And then after that, I started into therapy, like psychotherapy or whatever. Yep. I don't know what you call it. And it was all about like childhood. I was wanted to learn about my childhood. I don't want to just go, I had a great childhood. I want to figure it out. And like, so out of that came an album called Gravity again. And it's finally up there. And so this is like the third, now it's another concept record. It's about 467 Surf and Gun Club. It's way lighter. Let me say it's supposed to be a fun memory of those days with some sadness and wistfulness thrown in.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. And so, Robert, where would you say the best place for folks to go to hear all these streams is? Is it Bandcamp or Spotify?
Oh, my God, Bandcamp. There's another place I haven't put my shit.
Oh,
thank you
dude,
for telling me.
Please.
All right.
Bandcamp needs you to do it right now. Oh, my God.
It's going on Bandcamp.
Go do it right now before we finish the podcast.
All right. Hold on. You guys got to like, give me about 20 minutes. No. So it's on because Infinity Cat, Fixation Records, is it's named after my first album, Robert Ellis Oral, Fixation. So I decided I need a new label. I called it Fixation. And everyone that pre-orders the record, which they, you know, many people have, I'll just send them the CD and stickers and some membership cards to 467 Surfing Gun Club. You get all that with the pre-order. And I'm doing a commercial now. But
yeah.
But the vinyl comes in November, and I'll send that to you. But it's on all the streamers because Infinity Cat's distributed worldwide. So, I mean, we're everywhere.
So I think the thing to do is fire, you know, those three albums you talked about in succession. Just relax for a little while and just play all three albums and see what happens.
Yeah. Okay.
Probably. Yeah.
All right. I have two questions left. First question is this, because I'm so intrigued by you and your experience as a songwriter. How does it feel writing songs for yourself versus writing songs that you know are going to be recorded by other people?
Well, first off, if I'm writing for others, I have no idea if they're going to get recorded. So it's just a matter of my job. I always felt like this was my job. When I moved to Nashville, I learned this really quick because I'd only written songs for myself, really, up to that point with the three albums I made on RCA. But I knew that my job was to try to listen to, get to know what this artist is about, and then and sort of like amplify that back. It didn't matter. It mattered what they were about and not what I was about. So there's not a lot of personal things that come out of that. But when it when it came to songs that really did mean something to me, I always had a few things I could draw back on. Like, because I would write songs that I thought this is just going to make people cry so much that there's no way they're not going to cut this song. They're going to hear it. They're going to cry. They're going to put it in the album. It's going to be a hit. That never happens. It's about 95% failure rate. But one of the songs that it did happen was my go-to feeling of sadness is my now wife breaking up with me in high school, believe it or not, and then sort of getting control of the relationship, and then breaking up with me again in college for good, and then me knowing that she was the person that I knew. I definitely believed there was one person in the world for every person. I don't know why. Maybe because my parents seemed that, I mean, and they were married, you know, till they died and this in their
80s and 90s. Totally.
I mean, I wrote a lot of songs about that feeling. And the only place where really that art of really being up for, about me and commerce met, strangely enough, was a song called What If It's You. I'm writing you this letter. I know you're with this guy, and I hope everything goes well, but I am stuck with this. What if it's you? I was meant to be with my whole life, and now what am I supposed to do? And it was the title song of a Reba McEntire album, and a hit single for her. It was the first time it's something that, like, meant the world to me got recorded. So yeah, it's a whole different thing.
I've got something to tell you that I just can't say, so I'm writing it down in case maybe someday our lives take a turn down a road we can't see right now. Here to find. Oh.
Then when it comes back to writing just what I want to write,
mm-hmm.
I know there's no money in it, but I'm beyond that now. Obviously it's like, I'm good. I'm done. It's all been good. I haven't written, by the way, since I finished the last song for this record. Wow. I got piano right behind me, guitar on the wall. Still haven't written anything. I've written down some ideas, but I was thinking this is probably my last record.
Mm.
And then I'm thinking, well, I don't know, you might live another 20 years if you're lucky, so why would that be?
Yeah.
And you got your original band from 1980 to 84 on RCA on this record, and now they just want to hang out and they want to go in the studio. And I'm like, well, so here's my thought on
what
that.
What have you started here, Robert?
Yeah, here's my thought on that, by the way. From 80 to 84, had the same band, Kook, Don, and Dave. He's still Kook, Lowry. Kook, Lowry, and Don Walden, David Stefanelli. So they're like, hey, maybe we can go in the studio. I'm like, COVID. But maybe at some point that would be a thing we would do. But here's how I would do it. There's about 20 songs from 80 to 84 that were crowd favorites live. We never recorded them.
Oh, wow.
So wait, we take the same band with the same songs. I'm not going to write some new song and try to, you know, let's just cut the songs that we.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I think that would be the only way to do it. So yeah. Maybe there's one left in me. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. See, again, I listen to Nick Lowe, who is so inspiring to me to this day. Saw him live Franklin, Tennessee last year, stood on the stage for about 2 hours with his guitar, never tuned it once, never had to, just slamming one song after another, brilliant. And I'm like, this man is writing about his life right now. And maybe that's something I should think about doing too.
Okay, I got one last question. Okay. We'll let you go.
No, I don't want to go.
That's a first. Okay, so here's my question. How did you become a Swiftie?
All right. I became a Swiftie because as a songwriter, I was my daughter was 13. Taylor was 13. My daughter had just started asking me if I could write songs for her and her friends, one of which was Leon Russell's daughter. They wanted to start a band. And they were like, oh, I was like, okay, let's do a band. And they're like, okay, you write the songs. We'll tell you what to write them about. They were 13. And I was like, okay, what do you want the first song to be about? My daughter said, well, it's about how I don't want you to come into my room. And just walk into my room. So that literally is the first song I ever wrote for this band called Art Circus, which turned into not just my daughter. It was like all her friends and stuff. But my friend Angelo called me, Angelo Petraglia from Boston, Massachusetts. I met him in 1977 mm-hmm. in Henniker, New Hampshire, around a campfire. I'll never forget this guy. I'm shy. I don't know anybody. And he handed me a joint and he said, you want a hit of this? And I was like, sure. And then he's like, I'm Angelo. And I said, hi, I'm Bob. And we became friends. But Angelo called me up one morning and he said, I got this girl coming over. She's 13. I don't know. What do I write with her about? What do I mean? What you have a 13-year-old daughter. I was like, yep. And he's my age, by the way. So, you know, he was a little lost. And I said, I'm sorry. I already have a thing. You know, I have a writing appointment. And he goes, no, you got to help me. And I was like, Angela, I want to. And he said, she's on RCA. And I said, okay, I'll cancel and I'll be right over. And do you know, she was on RCA Records and they let her go. They let her walk. It's an amazing story in itself. And I know the details because I heard them from her and her parents time and time again. But so I came over and he said, what do we write about? I said, first off, we write about what she wants to write about. Secondly, this should be the most fun she's ever had writing. And if that's the way it works out, then we'll keep writing. And then we'll eventually get something that gets on a record. And wouldn't you know, the first two songs we wrote are on the first record.
On the first Taylor Swift record.
Yeah. Wow. That was A Place in This World and I'm Only Me When I'm With You. And we wrote that on day one and day two.
sky. Sometimes we don't say a thing, just listen to the crickets sing. Everything I need is right here by my side.
And then he kind of bailed off it. I won't go into this. I mean, she didn't have a stage mother. But there was someone calling all the time and saying, Taylor wrote six more songs yesterday. That was Scott, her father, who's sweet as can be and was the biggest supporter. But he like, I can't, I'm bailing. And so I went on to just keep writing with her. And, when she walked off of RCA, she had a manager at the time. And I said, he wanted to do like the biggest showcase ever because dad had money. Her father was a Merrill Lynch guy and was a very smart man. And he was willing to sink it all into, I mean, he really believed in his daughter. And
he wasn't wrong.
He wasn't wrong at all. Yeah, no, he was not wrong at all. We used to talk about it. I said to him the first day I met him, which was the day we wrote I'm Only Me When I'm With You, our first song. I said, you know, she's going to sell 3 million copies of her first record. And he was like, yeah, I think so, Rob. And we were both wrong. I mean, I think it's at 11 million now. But I just kept doing it. And she had this manager that wanted to do a big showcase, you know, like the showcase with the, you know, down at 12th and Porter. And I think he wanted to do it. And I was like, no. Why don't I get a gig at the Bluebird with like three like heavyweight old, you know, songwriters. And then it's going to come around to Taylor. And she was 14 at the time. And people are going to be like, what? Because she had so much confidence. And she was otherworldly in that way. I'd never met anyone like her in terms of like, just, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm doing. And this is what happened. It's what's happening. It's going to happen. And so that was the night that we put these packages out. I still have one in the closet over here. These packages out to all the A&R people, and they showed up. And then we looked around the room and a lot of people were there, and Scott Borchetta, just said, we're doing, he was a Universal promotion guy at the time. And he said, nope, cause he had ideas about starting his own label. And he saw his first act that night and said, that's it, we're doing this. And she was the first act on Big Machine.
Huh. Wow. So, that's an amazing story. Yeah. If not for you, Robert.
Yes.
You know, none of this would have happened, right?
No, see, that's first off, it's so funny because people sometimes say to me, yeah, but it would have happened anyway. I mean, she would have got a deal anyway. And I go, well, have you seen The Voice or like any other of like 12 different people where people sing and they're great and nothing happens?
Right.
So,
totally true.
So,
yeah.
So the history of it is, that night did happen. Would it have happened anyway? Yeah, I would think so.
Well, you know, I like this story.
Yeah.
This is
amazing.
Good. I'm glad it happened this way. So that's great.
And Robert, thank you so much, man, for sharing your time and all this. And great.
Thank you asking me.
Good Lord.
You.
We'll do a whole spinoff podcast just to hear you tell a story. We appreciate it.
That's right.
I know.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
Yeah, I can go on for about 3 years.
All right. We got that. Yeah, we got that.
All right, Robert Ellis Orrell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, man.
We so appreciate it. It's been a delight.
Thank
great
you,
connecting
guys.
With you after all these years.
Yeah, so great.
All right.
So great. Fun.
Thanks again.
You know, we built this place back in 71, 467, surfing gun. But he's still got aces
up his sleeve. He never leaves that corner booth. And if you buy him a round or two, I'll tell you things that you may not believe.
Great. I mean, so I think the thing to do is fire, you know, those three albums you talked about in succession, eat some of the mushrooms in your backyard, just relax for a little while and just play all three albums and see what happens.
Mushrooms. My brother lives in Norway and they eat mushrooms weekly that they pick out of the woods. And they go out
you
and they pick
be
these,
careful.
They pick these orange mushrooms in New Hampshire when we're up in New Hampshire with them. And and it's like, they're delicious. And it's like, yeah, but we can't just go out there and pick mushrooms. Yeah.
No, you gotta be a little careful. I would suggest a Four Doors mushroom guide before you go out there. Yeah.
Probably, yeah.